which has occupied most of my thinking for quite a time. A case history. Case history is something invented by the Harvard Business School. But a case history of the White Pass and Yukon route must go back to its beginnings in 1898. Many facts and a little fiction about the earlier history are well known. In that year, 1898, at a chance meeting in Skagway of Sir Thomas Tancred and Michael J. Heaney, the latter convinced the former that a railway could be built to connect Skagway with the head of Lake Bennett through some almost incredibly difficult mountain country. A financier named Graves was likewise convinced. Mike Heaney was one of the young contractors who built the mountain section of the CPR and was seeking new mountains to conquer. Sir Thomas Tancred was an English engineer operating at a time when England was a great source of money and enterprise in foreign fields. At all events, with English money, United States engineering, and Canadian contracting, a new Alaska-Yukon railway was built to serve the gold mining rush, to avoid some of the hardship and most of the enormous losses of horses and material arising through the climbing of the Chilkoot and White Pass trails. Unfortunately, by the time the Skagway-Bennett line was ready to run, the peak of the gold rush was over. The area was probably not nearly as rich as imagined and largely petered out after a few years. But the little railway was unwilling to peter out. The old saying about being dead but refusing to lie down could never have been better illustrated. Over the years, it was steadily becoming insolvent in greater degree and could pay scarcely any of its bond interest. This accumulated over the years to a figure of $2,458,000. The indomitable operating officials tried every conceivable means of earning something to prolong its life. Any activity which could produce a few dollars was fair game. Apart from the sternwheel paddle steamers between Whitehorse and Dawson City, it ran at one time over 300 horses as a winter express postal and passenger run. It went into the wholesale oil business before the days of the cylindrical railway tank, somewhere in the 1920s. It operated one of the first bush airplane systems. Grant McConachy acquired most of the planes as part of his build-up of what has now come the great CPR. One of the former presidents, the late Herbert Wheeler, mortgaged his house in order to provide monies for payroll after having contributed a good deal of capital in the pinches. I don't know how many of you gentlemen are in business, but how many of you would be prepared to mortgage your house to take care of payrolls? The senior officials drew no salaries during the winter months. When the company was almost at its last gasp, the Corps of the American Army Engineers took over the operation of the railroad to bring in material and supplies for the great center section of the Alaska Highway. They did not pay the railway much rent, and they made minimum renewals and improvements. They ran as many as 17 trains a day each way, and this with limited communications and signals, which is some indication of the capacity of the line. When the Army engineers withdrew at the end of the war and returned the management back to the original operators, the company was indeed very near to the end. It was showing some book profits, but only by major neglect of the maintenance of the line and equipment. It was at this point that an English financier named Norman Darcy, in association with Hambro's Bank, one of the great merchant banking institutions in London, acquired all the bonds, debentures, preferred stocks, and common stocks of the company, and decided that enough vitality still resided in the company to be worthy of a real attempt at rehabilitation. What really actuated them in this decision is hard to say, but there was a heady atmosphere in London at this time. Mr. Churchill had just been returned as Prime Minister, and England was, generally speaking, on the march. They spoke of White Pass as being something for the long-term future, the last frontier, something to go into grandchildren's portfolios. Accordingly, in 1951, a new Canadian company, the present White Pass and Yukon Corporation, was formed to hold the old bonds and stocks and oversee the operations. Its own debentures and shares were rather widely distributed among prominent English families, investors, effective control being kept by the original group and their friends. There have been lots of stories about who owned White Pass. Well, it's never really got out of the hands of the original English group. The wear and tear resulting from the US Army's heavy loading and generally intensive use of the railway facilities during the Second World War left important parts of the property in a virtually tumble-down condition. Some of you may remember it. There were broken windows, walls and roofs patched in poverty fashion, some floors rotten and unsafe. Some of the properties had not been painted ever. The two snowplows were heavy, antiquated affairs, very costly to maintain. On the operating side, damage claims and claims for shortages ran into thousands, tens of thousands. The river boats were a problem because for years during the late 1930s and the war years, neither manpower nor material was available for proper maintenance. With the building of the Dawson-Mayo Highway, the function of the steamboats disappeared in favour of highway trucks. But so little money was available that only second-hand equipment, outdated most of it, could be obtained by White Pass, and this was of all kinds, models and sizes and types. No two pieces were alike. To keep them running, a maintenance garage was needed. In this place, a number of components were manufactured by the company, which ordinarily would be brought in from outside. Control of quantities became a problem in itself. The repair parts were not only out of balance, but in many cases far in excess of requirements. Operating on the new highways in those days was usually a losing matter, although we always appreciated the way the Canadian Army upgraded the road in the 10 years the Army was in charge. Insurance was wholly inadequate. For example, the Wofford Skagway, which would have cost well over $1 million to replace, was insured for about a tenth its value. The staff included some quite elderly men who probably should have been on pension, but had kept on working because the company had no pension scheme. We have one now. The local atmosphere in both Whitehorse and Skagway was not friendly. Labour relations included some very bad spots. When I first saw the condition in November 1951, my heart sank. So much to be done, so uncertain the income, so shabby and unkempt the fabric. There was no possibility of borrowing nearly enough money at that time. One of the major financial houses flatly refused to have anything to do with it. My natural impulse was to cut and run. Why should one engage upon such a terrific undertaking with so many things stacked against it and so little likelihood of success? But there was a written obligation to maintain and operate the property, which, tied in with coastal steamers from Vancouver, was the veritable lifeline of the Yukon Territory. Most important was the personnel, old and young, who had some appreciation of the mineral capabilities of the country. The enthusiasm of these young people and their vision of what a revitalized White Pass organization might possibly do for the building of Yukon finally confirmed the conclusion to give the operation one more forward push. I'd like to repeat that it was the enthusiasm of these people as to what a revitalized White Pass could do for the community. There was another very bright spot in the person you all know, Mr. Fred M. Connell, who was producing lead zinc concentrates from the United Keno Hill properties and who owned asbestos claims in the Cassiar district. Fred Connell's name should be imperishable in the Yukon Territory. He was the one man who saw a future for mining in, a real future for mining in the Yukon at that time. The developments he undertook at what looked like a most unpropitious time are among the positive steps that brought the Yukon alive. With some prospect of reasonable tonnages of freight, it was possible to tackle some measures for improvement. It was possible to replace the old highway garage by a modern steel structure. Doesn't look very modern today. Adequate insurance was placed on the wharf and machine shops, as well as some public liability insurance, which previously had been lacking. Imagine running a railway without public liability insurance. What a hell of a way to run a railway. The railway shops at Skagway were rearranged to avoid backtracking. Examinations made of the stores and repair parts resulted in the weeding out of many obsolete items and duplications. That was a job in itself. A great deal of material was just plain junk and was written off or sent down to Vancouver for sale as scrap. Some of it didn't sell. The sheds on the riverbank at Whitehorse were all torn down. You must all remember what those sheds were like. They were useless, of course. The old steam locomotives with their high operating and maintenance costs were replaced gradually by brand new diesels, which of course had to be built to meet unusual ice and snow conditions, a narrow gauge, and were correspondingly expensive. A program of rail relay was undertaken, and gradually almost every mile was replaced. Special programs of track improvement, realignment, etc., were undertaken. Much emphasis was placed on safety measures. Further to strengthen the personnel of the organization was the employment of a public relations officer, whom you all know in the person of Roy Minter, and who is signaling to me when I'm going too fast. The appointment of Jack Hoyt as general manager at Whitehorse was another very constructive step. Jack's over there someplace. The old wharf at Skagway was almost completely rebuilt, and so was the depot at Whitehorse. The depot at Skagway, which goes back to the early days, is due to be replaced this year, if it doesn't tumble down before we get at it. That's serious. Another early move was the installation of IBM accounting machines in Vancouver, which made possible the production of financial and operating data in a shorter time and with greater accuracy and reliability. You can't do without IBM in anything of any consequence nowadays. All through the 1950s, the problem was whether the then existing mines were large enough to keep our line going or whether new ones could be found. In the years 1955 to 57, prospecting was at a low ebb. In an attempt to stimulate things, White Pass engaged the services of a young man who had just obtained his PhD in geology at UBC, in the person of Aero Aho, who, with Uncle Land, became one of the Yukon's ablest young explorers. We are more than happy at their success. Can you hear me? We were troubled continuously by breakages, shortages, and general disorder in package freight. Loss of time was another large factor arising from the storage of packages in ships' holds, and in company boxcars. We finally decided that the protection of our freight and freight business demanded that the goods should be packed in sealed containers. Some of these could be heated and some refrigerated to bring a reliable supply of fresh fruit and vegetables to the area. That's one thing White Pass claims it did for the community. The holds of the privately owned ships which served between Vancouver and Skagway were not suitable for the handling of containers. Therefore, after much careful consideration and calculation, it was decided in 1953 to build a ship with specially designed holds to store containers in transit. These containers to be offloaded intact from ship holds to railway flat cars and then to highway trucks. The picture of the thing is down below there, I won't go on. We named the ship after the longtime president of the company, Clifford J. Rogers, whose unconquerable spirit held the White Pass Company together in the very bad years. Our original planning had been to build a ship to handle containers of van size, 24 feet by 8 by 8. We found, however, that the wharves we used at Vancouver and Skagway were not strong enough for the larger containers. So it was decided to cut them down to one-third of the originally intended size. Thus, in 1955, the first ship built anywhere in the world from keel up as a container ship started its service between Vancouver and Skagway, going north with containers of general merchandise, returning south with containers filled with sacks of asbestos from the Cassiar mine. Boxes of lead zinc concentrates from United Kino were another major item. From the beginning, the scheme was a success. Losses and breakage practically disappeared. Cargo went north in proper order. One set of documents covered the whole trip from Vancouver to Whitehorse or further inland. As an extra service, we undertook pickup in Vancouver and delivery to the merchants at their place of business in Whitehorse. All right, Roy? In a very few years, the Rogers was too small to handle all the freight offering. And in December 1963, at a momentous board meeting, it was decided to undertake an $8 million expenditure for the building of a second, much larger ship with containers 25 feet 3 by 8 by 8. $8 million is a big sum of money in any company, but it was much bigger, relatively, for White Pass at that time. This plan included the expenditure on a new terminal in North Vancouver and the cost of rebuilding the wharf at Skagway. Thus, in November 1965, a new 6,000-ton ship came into operation, only just in time to take care of the increase in freight tonnage offering out of the Yukon. I felt very honored when the board saw fit to name the vessel after me. This ship and container system met the earlier needs of the mines and the community, but is now again too small for the requirements of the Whitehorse, Skagway, Vancouver trade. Hence, as has been announced, a second ship, a duplicate of that now in service, was arranged for and should be in operation late this summer. She is named after the Klondike. Her capital cost will be close to $6,200,000. And Vickers at Montreal, who built the ship, insisted she should be called Diamond Hill. The delivery of this ship and the new construction at Skagway marked the virtual completion of the cleanup of what we had inherited from the immediate post-war days. A railway operation always faces the need for expenditures on improvements of one kind or another. And there are still many things to be done. But with the program of expansion and improvement presently underway, the main job of rehabilitation is nearly at an end. Where did the money come from? For sure, none of it came from government sources. We have never received any subsidy, either in cash, in absorption of deficits, or in land grants, as have the two major railways. We have been entirely on our own. We have ploughed back 90.4% of all the cash income in 17 years. 90.4% is a big chunk of the money that was earned. I doubt if many companies can say that. Some will say, but no one in this hall, I would hope, that profits and cash dividends are bad words. A non-dividend paying company very soon finds its sources of funds for development dried up. So we, at all events, believe in both profits and dividends. And I say this unashamedly. Where else could the money have come from to do the job which I have outlined above? As a matter of fact, in the financing of the Rogers and the Brown, we did borrow a total of $2,900,000. And we have since borrowed or committed for another $11 million. In this connection, I quote from the annual report of a great telephone company. He says better than I can what I mean. Our earnings were strengthened to the benefit of our customers, our employees, and our shareholders. Only a company with a reasonable return can afford the cost of service improvement and efficient and economic expansion to meet customer needs, while at the same time increasing the rewards to its people. Our ability to attract capital to support the achievements of 1968 and to provide for the needs of tomorrow clearly depends on good earnings. I've said nothing so far about the developments arising from our contract with the Anvil Mining Corporation. I quote from your information an excerpt from the President's annual report to shareholders, which has recently been published. Quote, the ship basin at Skagway has been completed, and a good start has been made on the building of the wharves, storage sheds, ship loading equipment, and so on. It may be noted here that the Skagway facilities are designed to accommodate ships of 35,000 tons, loading at the rate of 1,500 tons per hour. Thus, 11 ships a year, loaded to capacity, would move in a total of 30 days the whole of the Anvil contract to 370,000 tons per annum. 30 days. That leaves 335 days with no shipping. In other words, the annual capacity of the wharf is 10 to 12 times the expected output of the Anvil mine. In round terms, the capacity is about 4 million tons a year. Independent engineering studies by first-class engineers indicate that our harbour at Skagway is capable of being developed to take, at the one time, a ship with a capacity of 100,000 tons, a 35,000-ton ship, and a general cargo ship of 8,000 to 10,000 tons deadweight. Therefore, at Skagway, a capability can be developed readily to handle 15 million tons of cargo. This surely should be enough to serve the requirements of Yukon for a few years ahead. Not forever. Contracts have also been let or are in process for 7 heavy locomotives, the replacement of the high trestle bridge at mile 18 by a tunnel and a much shorter bridge, strengthening and in some cases rebuilding retaining walls, bridges, numerous trackage improvements, including some rail, and in reballasting the whole line from one end to the other. 200 new flat cars, the construction of a new type of container for lead zinc concentrates, sundry improvements to accommodate heavier loads, a minimum of 30 highway tractor trailer units with the option to increase to 35. This is detailed stuff, but it's important that it be said. Most of the funds required by this extensive program will come by way of loans, the common and preferred stock issues, and the ploughing back. The money has been brought in, apart from the ploughed back money, brought in from outside. None of the funds will be derived from increased freight rates. Actually, when we brought the Brown in, we reduced the rates, one of the rate reductions. As a matter of fact, our freight rates have come down substantially over the years, as much as 42% on some items, but generally running 25 to 30% below the peak. I think you'll agree that this is a rather unusual trend for these days. Throughout the period of 1952 to 1965, the percentage or profit to average capital employed ran as low as 1.7% and never exceeded 4%, which I believe any businessman will regard as modest. The introduction of the brown, containerization, and the general increase in volume of freight led to savings of costs, so that the earnings since 1965 have been significantly better than previously. But over the whole 17-year period, the average profit runs not more than 4.6% on the capital employed. You will readily recognize the disparity between this return and the rates obtainable on bank deposits and first mortgages. I'm nearly at the end. By way of review, it would seem fair to say that White Pass has functioned as should be expected from any conscientious free enterprise concern, including the payment of extremely high taxes. We have constantly kept and do keep before us corporate goals as follows. One, to be customer-oriented, aiming to find out and serve their requirements as far as practical. Two, to be always ahead in the provision of new and more efficient facilities. Three, to run economically and to bear down upon any extravagant tendencies which might develop. Expense accounts are very closely scrutinized. To be a good employer, we believe we are. This includes the employment of people of Indian blood, which we do to the fullest extent possible and always have. We have a splendid West Indian in our Vancouver office. We have Chinese, an Eskimo, and several Central Europeans. We even have a couple of Englishmen. To encourage tourism in every way possible, our series of current films is an evidence of this. To be a good citizen, taking our place in public affairs, I think we do. To build up outside interest in the Yukon Territory. To bring in substantial amounts of capital from the outside. So far, including the money that's arranged for but not yet drawn down, the total is $14,200,000. That's apart from the plowing back money. To earn profits for our shareholders, but always to bear in mind the prime importance of a well-balanced development and expansion of the economy we serve. That's serious. None of this could have been accomplished without an unusually capable, inventive, and unremittingly loyal group of men. An exceptional fine team, such as is found in few business organizations. I'm happy to be able to pay the tribute to them. Thank you. Thank you.